From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Holiday sausage making on Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Deadline gamesmanship is underway in both houses of Congress. Bills that must pass before the holiday recess are loaded with so-called poison pills. Matters held hostage include payroll tax cuts, unemployment benefits, and appropriations to keep government agencies open. Both parties are playing the game, with the president threatening vetoes and saying that nothing gets done until everything gets done. Can Congress accomplish its basic work in time to go home for Christmas? What's the price of dysfunctional government in the long term? On Reporter's Notebook later on, should all cell phone use be banned for drivers? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Mormon Alney, back with To the Point. Another holiday means another deadline for important legislation in Congress and opportunities for each political party to embarrass the other. We'll hear what's at stake for the latest example of dysfunction. Government. On Reporter's Notebook, an influential government agency says it's not just texting and updating Facebook or watching movies, but any use of cell phones by drivers that ought to be banned. We'll hear some reaction. First, this news update. The president, who won office in part by opposing the war in Iraq, today celebrated its end with thanks to a crowd of soldiers at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Those last American troops will move south on Desert Sands, and then they will cross the border out of Iraq with their heads held high. One of the most extraordinary chapters in the history of the American military will come to an end. Iraq's future will be in the hands of its people. America's war in Iraq will be over.
Jamie Tarabay is managing editor of National Security and Foreign Affairs for the National Journal. At part of the war, he was NPR's Baghdad bureau chief at that point. Jamie Tarabay, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be back.
A difficult moment for the president, who obviously opposed the war, but he was very well received by the soldiers.
Right. Well, you know, as a candidate, he opposed the war. He said it was the dumb war, and instead that American security efforts should have been focused on Afghanistan and, you know, fighting al-Qaeda there. And, you know, speaking to reporters today, the press secretary said that, you know, Obama's position hadn't changed. He decided going in that, you know, as president, he wanted to end the war responsibly and spent, you know, the last 8 to 9 years doing so. So, you know, I mean, these are all the things that he's been working on since he came into office.
So he opposed the war and promised to end it, which is now happening, although it was on George W. Bush's watch that the withdrawal deadline was set.
Exactly, and that's been one of the sort of the more ironic aspects of all the opposition he's been getting from, you know, Republican presidential candidates at the moment, as well as people on the Hill criticizing him for the deadline, which was something that his predecessor signed. So he's actually just fulfilling the commitment of the George W. Bush administration.
Now, the president did, during his speech at Fort Bragg today, allude to 9 years of controversy over the war, but then he told the soldiers that their sacrifices have helped to unify the country.
For all of the challenges that our nation faces, you remind us that there's nothing we Americans can't do when we stick together. For all the disagreements that we face, you remind us there's something bigger than our differences.
So back to Jamie Tarabay. Certainly the president doesn't want the soldiers to think or Americans to think that this effort was all in vain, even though he opposed the war.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the disagreement that the president has is with the policy and the decision-making, and he has been at pains to ensure that that has not been at all reflected in his attitude towards the troops. You know, First Lady Michelle Obama, together with Vice President Joe Biden's wife, Jill, part of a military spouse program, you know, supporting military families. They've been trying to do everything that they can to help returning helping veterans find jobs and find support within their communities. You know, this has been definitely we have a problem with the policy. It is not the troops' fault. They are, you know, living with their heads high, regardless of what the conditions are on the ground as they, you know, as they leave Iraq and Afghanistan in a couple of years' time.
And there's going to be more injured veterans to deal with in the aftermath of this war than has been the case, proportionately at least, in other wars. He made a lot of promises to these veterans about all that's going to be done for them by the United States, for their families. One wonders what that's going to mean in terms of ultimate cost.
You know, Warren, you're so right. I mean, this is a part of the legacy of this war that this country hasn't even begun to feel yet. You know, the veteran unemployment is over 11%. You know, and as you said, so many more have been wounded, and because of the technology and the advances in you know, in medicine and scientific research, more have been able to survive the battlefield with injuries that would have killed them in previous conflict. So they're coming back with prosthetics and, you know, all sorts of other injuries, not to mention the psychological, mental trauma. And that is going to be a massive drain on the healthcare system in this country. And those are things that we haven't even begun to realize yet. And that's only a matter of time.
We just have 30 seconds left. As an NPR correspondent, you know what that means. But just very quickly, if you will, your own sense of what this means. You spent a lot of time in Iraq. How do you feel now that the war is over?
Well, you know, I think the war for America is over, and now the challenge is really going to be whether the Iraqis are going to be able to take care of themselves. And I just saw something very interesting about how the Iraqis have spent so much time trying to maintain security within their borders that they haven't really begun to think about how they're going to protect themselves from all these outside influences. And that, I think, is also going to be another challenge coming up for the Iraqis.
Jamie Terabay with the National Journal now. Thanks very much, as always.
Thank you.
In a moment, holiday sausage making on Capitol Hill on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Last night, the Republican-dominated House passed a bill extending payroll tax cuts and unemployment insurance. An hour later, the Senate's Democratic leader, Harry Reid, called it dead on arrival. Jonathan Allen is senior congressional reporter for Politico, and it's good, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a bill that's is supposed to be a must-pass bill. There are only a couple of days left in the session. What's going on?
I think you're getting the typical sort of year-end fighting, leverage-seeking from members of Congress in both parties, from the White House, and the final details just haven't been settled yet. What's going to be in that package? There are really two pieces of legislation moving right now. One is a gigantic spending bill funding most of the agencies of the government. There's apparently a deal on that, but Harry Reid and President Obama don't want to see it move until something gets done on the payroll tax cut. There's some concern that if that big spending bill gets done, then some of the other priorities, the priorities of the administration, will be left behind for next year. Not sure how realistic that concern is because, of course, that other package is headlined by the payroll tax cut. If something doesn't get done by January, people will see their taxes go up. But basically, the contributions that they've always made to Social Security will return to their normal level after a 2 percentage point break from the original taxation level this year.
There's also the unemployment extension as well. But in that bill is also a speeded up a scenario, I guess, a speeded up approval process for a very controversial project, the Keystone Pipeline.
That's right. The pipeline would bring oil from Canada down through the United States to Texas, and the president, or at least the president's advisors, have essentially held that up, held up the final permitting on that, and Republicans want to see a decision made on that sooner rather than later. So the bill would require the president to make that decision earlier than he would have to otherwise. Basically keeps the decision-making in the hands of the president, and I think Republicans think that's a good election year issue because either the president will in fact do this oil pipeline, which they think is a good policy, or he won't do it and they can hammer him for it politically because there's a lot of possible job creation from building that pipeline.
Job creation and, of course, controversy about it, particularly from environmentalists who call it a disaster, particularly because it brings down the shale oil from Canada, which they say contributes to a global warming, or the mining of it does. So we have this bizarre situation today, then, where a Republican bill comes over from the House, and then the Republicans in the Senate don't want to have a vote on it until they voted on something else, namely the appropriations bill.
Right. Everybody's holding each other's legislative children hostage right now. In some cases, their own legislative children are being held hostage, all trying to get an opportunity to make the case that their way of doing things is better. In this case, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell doesn't want to see his partisan brothers' House bill fail on the Senate floor and give leverage to Harry Reid to say that that measure just can't pass in the Senate. So still a lot of posturing going on. But I'm getting the sense that rank-and-file members are a little bit tired of this, and they're kind of ready to go home, call it quits on the first session of the 112th Congress, where they're settling around 9% approval ratings. Nobody really wants to stick around here for an ugly fight.
So who's liable to give in first?
I think that's the $64,000 question, or if you're Mitt Romney, the $10,000 bet, I guess. still unresolved.
I'm not going to put anything up on either side. Jonathan Allen, again, senior correspondent, congressional correspondent for Politico. Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow on the Center for at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. He's former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. He's a familiar voice on our program. It's good to have you back.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, Warren.
So is this any way to conduct government?
No, I was thinking as I was listening to Jonathan, I'm ready for them to go home, too. I just want to see them complete some of this very important work. Remember, both of these economic programs we're talking about, the extension of unemployment insurance benefits, a continuation of benefits that are currently in the system, for that matter, and the payroll tax holiday, these are measures that are in the economy right now. They've been in effect in 2011, and they've been helping boost paychecks a bit and creating more of a safety net for low-income people. And I think it's unquestionable, if you look at the state of the economy and how typical families are doing, it's unquestionable that we still need these measures in the economy. So what Jonathan just described is a lot of, I think, very unfortunate but expected political jockeying around issues that mean a lot to middle-income families. I mean, it's this kind of jockeying that explains that 9% approval rating.
Jared Bernstein again, a former aide to Vice President Joe Biden. Doug Holtz-Eakin is president of the American Action Forum. He was an economic advisor to Senator John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Do you agree that the unemployment tax break and the unemployment extension and the payroll tax break are as important as Jared Bernstein thinks they are?
Well, I think we know that they've had some impact. Modest would be the probably the right term. And we know that, you know, Republicans agree because they've passed through the House a bill that, in fact, extends the payroll tax break and reauthorizes the unemployment insurance. So, you know, I think the characterization of the politics has been dead on the mark. I mean, this is holding each other's children hostage when there's bills to be finished, and they should finish the spending bill, and they should pass the tax bill, and they should go home.
So who do you think will give in first?
You know, it shouldn't be looked at that way. I think Senator Claire McCaskill said it right this morning when she said that she wanted Harry Reid to not talk about things being dead on arrival, but instead say, look, we can make a deal here and get it done so that it doesn't have to be one side or the other side giving in, but instead we go back to the sort of time-honored practice of principal compromise and we get the bills done.
And Claire McCaskill, of course, a Democrat.
Yes.
Jared Bernstein, what about it? Should the Democrats give in?
I think Doug's right. I mean, I think the art of politics, especially in a divided Congress, is compromise. And that means both sides have to give something. Now, I will say that I think you've got these kind of interesting and I think pretty dysfunctional, intractable positions. I mean, on the one side, you have the Democrats saying, we're going to pay for this with a surcharge on millionaires, a total non-starter for Republicans. Now, it is true that the folks at the very high end of the pay scale are the only ones who've benefited from what growth we've had so far, so there's some logic to that, but politically it's a non-starter. And then the Republicans say the only way we're going to pay for this is through spending cuts, and the Democrats reasonably say, well, actually it needs to be some revenue in the deal. So I think Doug's right. I mean, I think there has to be some compromise. I don't know that I think there are ways in which both sides could give a little something. But if you're talking about the XL Keystone pipeline, that's beyond compromise. That's a poison pill. There's no way that should be part of this discussion.
Doug Holtz-Eakin, what about that?
I guess I disagree on the Keystone XL. I mean, the decision to suspend permitting was clearly a purely political decision by the president. This is a situation where we will learn nothing in a year that we don't know now. The aquifer is well understood. There are pipelines there already. And to let those politics trump the creation of those jobs and the necessary energy infrastructure is a great shame. And it's especially a shame in a time when we so desperately need jobs and when a job, as President Kennedy famously said, is the best form of welfare anyone could hope for. So these programs that they're fighting about have a place in the economy, but the real battle is over jobs, and I think the Keystone XL deserves the consideration that they've put on.
Jared Bernstein, what are the environmental objections, particularly having to do with aquifers and other issues as well?
Well, I mean, I think that Doug has a point in the following sense. This may be a perfectly fine project, but there's no way we're going to be able to have the necessary debate within the next 2 weeks to resolve it. There are concerns on the other side, shale oil and the potential leaking from a pipeline. Apparently this particular type of oil can be particularly invidious if it leaks out into the environment. And so we have to take some time and evaluate concerns on both sides. That's not going to happen in 2 weeks, and this thing expires in 2 weeks. So while Doug may have a great point, this may be the most wonderful energy policy to come down the pipeline, no pun intended, for years, you can't resolve it in the time frame we have. So in that sense, it's absolutely, unquestionably a poison pill designed to just grandstand and go through the kind of games we're going through.
Well, isn't it also, Jared Bernstein, designed to make things difficult for the president with his environmental supporters who are absolutely opposed to the Keystone pipeline? The NRDC has put out a video on it with Robert Redford thanking him for delaying the decision, and he can't afford to be to offend that particular base of his support again, can he?
No, I mean, I think that's what I'm saying, that the environmentalist views against the pipeline strike me as germane and important, and it's going to take a little bit of time for us to evaluate them. Whether we pass, if this pipeline is a great idea, the next 2 weeks actually don't matter in terms of its passage. It will be in place for much longer than that. We have a responsibility to take this apart and look at it much more carefully. To jam it through on emergency legislation like this makes no sense.
So, Jonathan Allen, back to you, senior correspondent for congressional correspondent for Politico. Here we have a Republican and a Democrat both agreeing that it's time to compromise, but neither one of them able to agree on the compromise.
Well, it's very easy to want to compromise. It's hard to find compromise, and I find that most times in Congress when they get things done, it's more about finding common ground that exists and being willing to occupy that same common ground rather than actually making deals or compromising on things that each side believes in. Right now, I think that a point that was made earlier, I mean, these are sort of mutually exclusive goals to some extent that are in operation right now. Certainly, the ways in which the payroll tax cut would be paid for, the two sides have their basic economic beliefs at odds with each other. And as far as the Keystone XL pipeline goes, I mean, the reason that it's in this legislation now, in this emergency legislation at the end of the year, is because there's no other possibility for it to go through Congress. There's no way that Democrats would let it go unless it was tied to something like the payroll tax cut. So this is the only way it would go. I still think it remains to be seen whether that ends up in the final analysis. The president's stick of the payroll tax cut, I think, is larger than the stick that the Republicans have with the Keystone XL pipeline. It's a good issue to help blunt some of the criticism they're getting, but it's not the bigger issue. It's not the one that changes people's paychecks on January 1st or January 9th or whenever everybody gets paid for their jobs. whereas the payroll tax cut, people will actually see their paychecks go down as a result of that.
Doug Holt-Eaton, back to you, formerly with the McCain campaign and a director of the Congressional Budget Office. What about the spending bill to fund most of the government agencies? How important a bill is that?
I think it's an absolutely crucial bill. First of all, it's the Congress's job to pass these appropriations bills every year, and one of the reasons they have a 9% approval rating is they're not doing the nuts and bolts of their job on a regular basis. And so to see them complete this, even a couple of months late, would be a good sign and hopefully would set a precedent for getting it done next year on time. Then there's the issue of, if they don't get it done, by the time the continuing resolution expires, we get back into the brinksmanship of shutting down the government. Both sides are tired of that. The American public's tired of that. And so there are two things here that we would like to avoid, a shutdown and a failure to do the job.
Jared Bernstein, you work for Joe Biden. President Obama is saying now that he wants everything to get done or nothing gets done. Now, how serious is that? Is he really going to hold the Congress up and prevent them from going home for the holiday? Or is there a possible shutdown of the government, do you think?
I think that the we'll avoid a shutdown. They'll pass the continuing resolution. We've seen every time this issue of a shutdown comes up, there's a last minute coming together, and I suspect that'll happen again. Look, I want to take up something you said a second ago, intimating that we actually, we're talking about compromises, but we don't really have them. I can articulate a perfectly legitimate compromise. It's a little bit in the weeds, but since you asked, there are things that we've been talking about this for a while, so there are things that we agree on. There's increasing fees to what's called the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie. That raises $36 billion. There's some employee pension and contributions, some salary stuff that the Republicans have been pushing for. That's about $40 billion. There's some stuff you could do on Social Security, on unemployment insurance, on auctioning the spectrum, all these little cats and dogs. But you've got to also have something on the revenue side in order to do this. If a 2% tax on millionaire surcharge is too high for the Republicans, then we should take it down some. But it's got to be balanced. It's got to come both from revenue and spending cuts if we're going to go that route at all.
Doug Holt-Eaton, we need to go to a break, but very quickly, if you can, do you agree with that some revenue really is needed?
No, I don't. I think it's odd to make the claim that we need to keep a tax cut in place and the best way to do it is to raise taxes. I mean, it just is internally inconsistent. So, that's been the policy problem for quite a while. There are ways which are genuinely progressive that involve having high-income seniors pay more for their Medicare, that involve having them means-test other government benefits that would have the same distributional effect, would be much more benign economically, and which should be a way to pay for this.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a break. On Reporter's Notebook later, should all cell phone use be banned for drivers? Back in a moment with this conversation on To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. I want to thank Jonathan Allen, senior congressional reporter for Politico, for being on the first part of our program about the sausage making on Capitol Hill at a holiday time with kind of deadline gamesmanship going on. Some call it dysfunctional government. One of those is Sarah Binder, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, professor of political science at George Washington University. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about this as an example of dysfunctional government. What are the potential costs of it in the long run?
Well, there are a number of costs here for the fact that Congress can't seem, the two political parties can't seem to find relatively sometimes obvious, sometimes not obvious solutions in the middle of the spectrum. And first and foremost, as we've seen all year, it's simply the plummeting of the Congress's public standing, right? When you get below 10%, let alone below 20%, you have an institution that's really losing, if not lost, its legitimacy, by which we mean it's people's perceptions that it can solve problems, which, of course, is why we sent people to Washington in the first place. Second of all, there's always a question whether dysfunction, in fact, has an economic consequence, right? Sometimes we say, well, gridlock is good, government gets out of the way, but I think we saw this summer that stalemate over the debt ceiling, in fact, as Ben Bernanke said, probably cost the economy. So there are numbers of costs here that flow from Congress's inability to see problems the same way and to reach solutions to them.
I saw a poll recently that indicated that when people were asked, do you think the Republicans ought to be in charge of both houses in the White House or the Democrats ought to be in charge of both houses or the White House, what they really preferred was that one party be in charge of one house and one party in charge of the other, so they put a check on each other. Do voters fully understand, do you think, what that means?
Well, they may now understand. I think it's certainly true both historically as well as in the last 10, 20 years or so, that voters have a preference for a divided government, right, that it enforces and enhances these limits on what government can do. Now, oftentimes we say, right, divided government, that's precisely the conditions we need in order to get tough things done, right? The two parties hold hands and jump off the cliff together. But that doesn't work, right? That dynamic doesn't work if the parties are polarized, right? Because then the incentive is really just to push the other party over the edge and prove to your base that you're still standing. So split party control may have some benefits. In a period of low polarization, we might in fact see the parties come together, see these grand bargains we saw, for instance, tax reform in the 1980s. But when the parties move so far apart and have such incentives to disagree with the other party, it's not clear to me that split party control is actually up to the task of governing.
Let me go back to Doug Holtz-Eakin, formerly director of the Congressional Budget Office, also associated at one time with John McCain. How long can Congress afford to have its approval rating at 9%? And what about the risk of losing legitimacy? What are the consequences of that?
Well, I think it's a very real concern, and I think there are a couple different aspects to it. The first is that we are seeing not grand shifts in public partisanship, but grand shifts against all incumbents, and there's a great dissatisfaction. If you see continual turnover, where we take the incumbents, throw them out, put in a new group, you lose any sense of policy stability because people have no idea what exactly it is that they were punished for, what they're supposed to accomplish. A lot of expertise gets lost in the process, and I'm very concerned about that. We have great policy challenges. We need tax reform. We need entitlement reform. We have deep concerns about financing our military in a time of budgetary distress. We can't afford to be not making progress on those problems because of dissatisfaction with Congress. The second thing is that I think it really raises the stakes for any president. Congress is inherently partisan. If you watch it, there are chairmen and ranking members. There are majority staffs and small staffs. There are majority offices and bad offices. And there's an inherent partisanship there. And the only person well situated to deal with that is the White House. The president can say to the members of his party, look, I know it's a tough vote. I'll cover for you. I'll campaign. I'll raise money. And he can say to the other party, look, I know this is important to you. I'll make sure it's in the final package or I won't sign. And we need not ordinary but extraordinary presidential leadership at this moment.
Jared Bernstein, back to you. You were with the vice president's office. The president has been accused in the past few months of being too detached from this process, not exerting the kind of leadership that Doug Holtz-Eakin suggests he should.
Well, I don't think that's a fair criticism. I think the president tried to involve himself, for example, with the debt ceiling, and all that happened is every time he suggested a solution, if Obama suggests it, the opposition says no, regardless of whether it's smart or even favorable to their initial causes and requests. So I think the problem is very clearly, and I think the previous two comments kind of circle in on this, the problem is very clearly a level of partisanship and gridlock that is unique to this Congress and the last couple of years. And while this may bring some satisfaction to the Tea Party base, what I'm starting to see happening out there in the country is that independents, who typically are deciding important narrow elections that are coming up, are no longer just kind of shaking their heads in disgust and saying, oh, those guys are always going to, they're always going to do the wrong thing. That may be a luxury you can have when the unemployment rate is 5%. But when we're stuck with the kind of problems we have now, people are beginning to wonder if this kind of dysfunction is something that the country can sustain. And I think they're concluding that it isn't. So I think that actually what we're going to see moving forward is a big enough chunk of the electorate totally fed up with someone who goes to Congress to shut the whole operation down. It's not the president's fault. It's the partisans that have simply been proffering dysfunction since they got here.
Sarah Bender, back to you. Do you agree that this is unique to this Congress, or have we seen this before?
Well, we've seen a gradual ratcheting up of partisanship and polarization, at least since the mid to late 1980s. So it's been underway for some while. That said, partisanship, polarization was rampant in the 19th century, right? So when we look back over the late 30s, 40s, 50s, the sort of moderate mid-century period, that's really the historical anomaly. That is, we've really gone through, this country's gone through these periods before, and ultimately it takes some long-term electoral change to try to move the parties toward the middle.
So is this something that is built into our constitutional system of government?
Well, certainly the difficulty of legislating is built into the system. Right, just and simply, not least of all the rules of the game and so forth, and the sharing of powers, but the fact that presidents, senators, and House members, right, have their own electoral bases and different electoral timelines. Right, so there's no command and control for leaders here. Right, they have to convince members that what's in the party's interest or what's in the nation's interest is also in their own electoral interest, and that can be a very tough hurdle for leaders to win on.
Constitution doesn't say anything about political parties. What about a possible third political party? When Jared Bernstein talks about the independents who are fed up with both sides, is that likely? I know there are some efforts now to get a third party nominee for president.
Well, the institutional barriers to third parties and to independents are very real in this country, right? Particularly in terms of winning the presidency, right? And given the electoral college, you can't have pockets of support. You have to be pretty broad spread in your support across the country, and that just makes it much harder. Right? There's this Americans Elect process going on, which is, if anything, is terribly well-funded and so potentially has a possibility of being a spoiler, but I think we're somewhat a ways from ever seeing a third-party candidate.
We've talked about the bill to extend tax breaks, the payroll tax breaks and the unemployment benefits. We've talked a bit about the omnibus spending bill to keep the government in business. We haven't talked about the defense bill, which is also a subject of last-minute controversy. Massimo Calabresi is Washington correspondent for Time magazine, and it's good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit, if you will, what is the Defense Authorization Act, how much money is involved with it, and what are the partisan disputes that are holding it up?
Well, as you know, the Authorization Acts merely state the congressional committee's desires for sort of policy in the different agencies of government, and then the appropriators specify the specific amounts of money that are going to go to the different areas indicated by the authorizers. But there have been a number of controversial provisions. The most one of the most controversial in the 2012 Defense Authorization Bill has concerned elements of the prosecution of what used to be called the War on Terror, and Obama has threatened to veto the Defense Authorization Bill, a veto that remains on the table, over not so much threats to civil liberties that some groups like the ACLU and others are concerned about, so much as limits that the bill might place on how he goes about counterterrorism in the United States.
And what sort of limits are those? Are they limits in powers that were originally asserted by George W. Bush?
Well, indeed, a lot of what the civil libertarians are concerned about in this bill is a kind of congressional codification of much of what President Bush pursued. Originally, the bill did have some specific codification of things like military commissions being required for certain categories of suspects, including in some circumstances American citizens. In the face of the veto threat and with concerns raised both on the left and the right about some of the issues pertaining to American citizens, That language has not so much been removed as made more vague and less easily interpreted with a series of amendments. And today, the FBI chief, Robert Mueller, was up on the Hill saying that he still is worried about constraints that the bill may impose on FBI agents as they detain and interrogate terrorism suspects.
Massimo Calabresi with Time Magazine. Jared Bernstein, back to you once again, formerly with the vice president's office. Joe Biden is the vice president. What about this? Is President Obama threatening to veto something because it would take away powers that he once thought were too great for George W. Bush?
I think the president has tried to show a kind of dynamic flexibility on issues like this, and believes that the war on terror is morphing in ways that require resetting of some of these priorities. I also think that what's particularly important from an economic and a fiscal perspective right now is that there is some bipartisan consensus, including people who are way at the opposite ends of the political continuum, people like Barney Frank and Ron Paul, on actually putting defense spending on the table. And that's really important, because if we're talking about spending cuts across the federal government, 20% of the budget is defense, and everything's got to be on the table. And no longer is it do you necessarily clear the bar by just accusing your opponent of being weak on national security. You've got serious people who really understand how the defense budget works, where the waste is, saying, no, we actually could take some serious, they actually could take some serious spending cuts, just like other parts of the budget.
Does this depend on the holiday deadline, or could this not be passed and taken up in January?
Well, I think this has to be part of the continuing resolution. I mean, this is we have to authorize all the departments to have funding once it runs out.
Doug Holt-Seaton, back to you. Again, you were involved with Senator John McCain's presidential campaign. He, of course, is very concerned about defense spending. What's your take on this?
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that, we've spent a good part of the past half hour discussing how Congress can't compromise, can't get to a deal, and they did that on the defense authorization bill, and now it's the administration that is holding things up. One hopes this gets resolved. It is important for the Pentagon not just to have its dollars, but to have the policy guidance of the administration and the Congress on how to spend those dollars, and that's what's at stake with this bill. I do think, everyone recognizes that defense spending is already on the table. The Budget Control Act that was passed in August is going to impose a $50 billion cut come January 1, 2013 in the Pentagon budget, the single largest item in that automatic spending cut. So far from the spending not being on the table, it's the centerpiece right now.
So, Massimo Calabresi, back to you with Time Magazine. What are the prospects in the next couple of days of coming to some sort of compromise on this? Does the president show any sign of backing off his veto threat?
Yeah, well, there is already conference language on the bill. So Congress's ability to change things now is, it's still possible, but it's harder. The president's veto threat was different from traditional veto threats. He didn't specifically identify this bill, even in his early veto threats, getting crosswise with what he considered to be the requirements of the executive branch, and he used vaguer language than presidents sometimes do. So he's got a bit of wiggle room on it, and the expectation is in an election year, does a president really want to veto a bill that's vague in the ways that it limits, and if anything, sort of expands executive authority in the so-called war on terrorism? There's a fair amount of speculation that he'll back down in the end.
Very quickly, though, what would it mean? What's the FBI director worried about in the case, for example, that's often used, the underwear bomber? How differently would he have been treated had this bill been in effect?
Well, in its original form, it would have required Abdulmutallab, the underwear bomber, to have been handed over almost immediately to the military rather than being interrogated and eventually put on trial, successfully put on trial. through the Article III courts. In its altered form, there are waivers, the language is mushier. Mueller says that he's still concerned that as the FBI is in the middle of a process of interrogating someone, they're going to have to think about whether they need to pause and go get a waiver or whether they need to get some other clearance from higher-ups rather than proceeding with their efforts to extract intelligence and confessions and so forth.
So, Jared Bernstein, a guess from you. Do you think that Massimo Calabresi is right and probably it's the president that will back down on this given the fact that the language is as vague as it is?
You know, I'm loath to take bets on this area. It's not my central area of expertise. I think Maximo has a strong point. The president, though, continues to work for compromise on this, and he may actually have more traction than you think.
But Massimo Calabresi, there is this human rights issue having to do with the treatment of American citizens.
Yeah, sadly, for those who focus on those issues, they've been the first tossed under the bus over the course of the last 2 or 3 years. There was a period immediately following Obama's inauguration when he tried to hew to closer to his campaign rhetoric on these issues, but a period of intense and fairly effective Republican attacks on these issues had him swing demonstrably to the center by May of 2009, and that's pretty much where he's been since then.
Dynamic flexibility, according to Jared Bernstein. Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. Covered a lot of ground. Massimo Calabresi with Time Magazine, Sarah Binder at Brookings and George Washington University, Doug Holtz-Eakin, formerly the director of the Congressional Budget Office, now president of the American Action Forum, Jared Bernstein, formerly of the vice president's office, now at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and our earlier guest, Jonathan Allen, with Politico. Good to have you all. The National Transportation Safety Board, after investigating numerous crashes, says that talking on wireless headsets while driving a car is just as dangerous as holding the phone to your ear. Is it time to ban cell phones from anybody who's driving a car? Back in a moment with To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with Popota's Notebook on To the Point. 10% of American drivers think it's up to them to decide if they can text or tweet or talk on a cell phone while they're behind the wheel. A lot of that, of course, has been made illegal in some states. But now the National Transportation Safety Board says all states should ban all cell phone use by drivers except during emergencies. Joe White is senior editor at the Wall Street Journal. He also writes the column Eyes on the Road. Joe White, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
How have they reached this conclusion?
Well, they were investigating this really horrific accident, this pileup, and they concluded that one of the causes of it was a driver of a truck who was apparently, based on the phone records, texting while he was driving. And I think what we have here is the national NTSB essentially saying the way to prevent, you know, the thousands of deaths that are attributed to this kind of distracted driving is to simply ban it. The problem is you can't simply ban it. It's either a very complicated technological fix, and even if you can get the technology right, the marketing and the sort of the sociology of talking and on the phone while you're behind the wheel and the behavior around that is going to be much more difficult to police, much more difficult to handle from a regulatory point of view. And they're going to get a lot of pushback from the auto industry on this.
Before we go to the technology, though, you said that they based this on a truck driver who was texting while driving. But don't they say that even hands-free use of a cell phone is sufficiently distracting that drivers ought not to be able to do it?
Yes, they do. There has been research out there for quite a while, and the NTSB appears to be, you know, taking this view that it isn't just the physical act of wrestling with your iPhone or your BlackBerry. It's the fact that your mind is distracted and that you are not paying attention to your surroundings. And honestly, I think if you or any of your listeners have ever done this, you know, talked on the phone while driving, or made the mistake of looking at email on a handheld device, you'll know that your thoughts can very quickly, you know, kind of leave the road and leave what's going on around you, and you focus in on that task, and you can travel a really long way in 5, 10, or 15 seconds in a fast-moving car. And not know what you're doing, and it is very dangerous. I think there's going to be a big debate, though, over whether you can have a hands-free system that allows you to interact with a phone in a certain way and still be safe. And the car makers will say yes, and obviously the NTSB is taking the position that the answer is no.
Why does it have to get technological? Why can't you just say drivers can't do it?
Well, because in a lot of states those laws already exist, and yet it's pretty clear that drivers are doing it. It's almost, I think, an addictive behavior, and I think it's also an adaptive behavior. I mean, people who are running to and fro around a metro area, as many people do, they get on the phone to call their spouses, you know, check on their kids, call a business associate. There's all sorts of reasons why you think it's okay to call on the phone. I have to say, I think texting on the phone is a little different. I think there's more disapproval of that, even amongst people who admit to doing it. They recognize that State Farm Insurance did a survey or a study recently of this, and you know, people's attitudes in that survey were clearly much more negative toward people texting behind the wheel than talking behind the wheel. I think those might be two different things in as far as many people are concerned.
If you have ever had the misfortune of being with a driver who is texting while driving, you can understand that feeling very clearly. Well, tell us again about the auto industry then and what they're saying about how difficult it would be to fix this technologically.
Well, the auto industry, I think you have to look at this in a slightly bigger picture. The auto industry is investing an enormous amount of time and money in developing very sophisticated multimedia systems in their cars. It used to be you had to buy a high-end luxury car to get a navigation system, you know, in a car with a screen and all of that stuff. Now these systems are available on all sorts of mass-market cars, and increasingly the industry wants to go towards systems such as Ford Sync or GM's OnStar or the systems that are available now in many Hyundai cars, which are very affordable mass-market cars. And you have a screen, and your radio, your navigation, your MP3, and your phone are all integrated electronically through this system, so that you can give voice commands and tell your car find the nearest McDonald's and all of this stuff. And it's magic as far as the car companies are concerned, because of course it's a feature that they can sell. And they increasingly plan to use your smartphone as the brains for these systems. So a call to ban the use of phones in the car entirely would disable a lot of these systems. And I was with some folks at Ford last night, and they're very concerned about this because this is a threat to a very powerful piece of business of theirs. And they just don't believe that it's necessary, that they believe that you can compromise on this. And I think what you're going to have is a very spirited debate among the car makers and safety advocates over how much of this multimedia access in a car is really safe.
You've written, though, in your column, Eyes on the Road, that a lot of consumers have complained that these systems are just too complicated to operate, especially while they're driving.
Well, that's right. And I've experienced this myself. I mean, I like to think of myself as some sort of a car expert, but I get behind the wheel of a high-end German car, as I did in this past week, and the car is lovely. The multimedia system is amazing, but the first couple or 3 hours, at least, that you're using this thing, it's kind of scary because you know it's just hard to figure out how it works. But what the car companies believe is that if they can get the interfaces to be easier to use, and specifically if they can get them to be voice activated, where you know, for those of you who remember Star Trek, you could just say to your car, you know, take me to the steakhouse, or you know, find a gas station, and it would just do it. Then, you know, the argument is, well, then it's all going to be okay. You're not going to be struggling with these menus. I think the problem is that the gap between that vision and today's reality is pretty substantial, and it's a question how long it's going to take to get there. And when you have, respected voices like the head of the NTSB saying this whole business is going the wrong way. We need to shut it down. I think that's going to be a point of conflict.
We just spent a lot of time talking about dysfunctional government. Does the NTSB have the power to do this? Would it require a congressional action? How might it happen?
They don't. You get into the alphabet soup here. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration does have the power to regulate, and in fact, fairly soon, I don't know exactly when, but fairly soon, they're supposed to come forward with some guidelines, and I'm going to stress that word, not rules, guidelines, on how these multimedia systems ought to be designed to minimize distraction. Now, could the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, it's called NHTSA in the industry, which is part of the Department of Transportation, could they initiate a rule saying, you know, all cell phone use of any sort in a car while in operation is banned, full stop? Yes, they could. And the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, has been evangelizing against distracted driving since pretty much day one after President Obama appointed him. But he's going to get pushback on this, as I suggested, a lot of it.
Yeah. Okay. You hope that Google will develop the car that can drive itself. Joe White, thanks
right.
a lot for being on our program.
Anytime.
Wall Street Journal column, Eyes on the Road. Today's program produced by Caitlin Schamberg with Katie Cooper and Christian Bordahl. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.